Another Tasmania Talks podcast. Go to tasmaniatalks.com.au for anything you've missed.
You have been hearing, no doubt, over past months, the word Iran keep popping into news stories. The sorts of stories you have heard the term, or the name of the country, Iran, mentioned in association with, as recently as today, there have been dual nationals, Australian and UK dual nationals, arrested and charged with, well, what kind of offences, God only knows, in Tehran. They're currently in a Tehran prison. This is causing a diplomatic incident as we speak. The Iranians are also, as you're probably aware, attempting and have been for some time now to develop nuclear weapons with one express purpose, and that is to wipe their neighbour Israel off the map. They have said so publicly over and over again for many years. As soon as this happens, that's going to be what they'll do with it. The extent to which the world believes them is another thing entirely. We have the ongoing situation of the nuclear deal that was meant to prevent the Iranians acquiring a nuclear weapon and indeed developing the ballistic missile technology to deliver said nuclear weapon. It was always described by those on what you might call the right of politics as being a deal stitched up by Barack Obama that inevitably enabled Iran to continue covertly producing weapons-grade or near-to weapons-grade uranium for their said bomb. But it was only really kicking the issue down the road. It kicked it down the road about a decade. So beyond that point, you'd either need a new deal or it's all systems go for the Iranian nuclear weapons program. There are other issues in terms of the cash that was freed up when the original deal was done, the nuclear deal with Iran. They got tens of billions of dollars, much of which they've used to sponsor terrorism in the region. The funding of the organization Hezbollah, another issue in the news over the past few days. There have been border clashes, in fact, for a couple of weeks now, border clashes in an area I was only a couple of months ago on the Lebanese border and just over the Syrian border as well from Israel. There's a fair bit going on in this space. Oil tankers, for example, that are being seized in the Strait of Hormuz by the Iranians, despite claims that they're not being used to break the Syrian embargo, are in fact being used for exactly that. There was a tanker spotted off the coast of Syria that was reported abducted, wrong term, but you know what I mean, by the Iranians. Then there's the increasing use of the Revolutionary Guards in Iran. Then there's the actions in the past, and to an extent still going on, of Hezbollah, a terrorist organization funded by Iran, taking part in battle on a couple of fronts in both Syria and also in Iraq. So the Iranians have got their fingers in all sorts of pies at the moment. And there's as you know, they've produced an argument between the United States and the Europeans and the UK. So US on one side, Europe and UK on the other, as to whether they stay in the nuclear deal or not, or decide to get out of it on the basis that the Iranians have now admitted that they're going to increase their uranium enrichment. So it's sort of like the Iranians are thumbing their noses at much of the world now, and unfortunately it appears that Barack Obama's lucrative anti-nuclear deal has aided and abetted them, stirring up the region. To that end, I want to bring in here, if I can, and I'm hugely privileged to have this chat, Benham Talablu is a senior fellow at a Washington think tank called the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. His specialty is Iran. He is a Farsi speaker, and he has published opinion pieces and advice for all of us on, say, for example, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, Reuters, do I need to go further, Associated Press, Agence France Press as well. I've got him on the line from Sydney now, and I appreciate his time. Ben, and welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be with you.
How much of a threat does Iran pose?
To the region, to its own people, to the world, I think the answer to all three of those is a quite significant level. If you had to rate it on a 0 to 10 scale, I'd say it's anywhere from a 6 to 8, but that 6 to 8 is growing.
Okay.
And knowing the kind of threats that the regime poses to its neighbors, for instance, with its proxies in the region, to its own people with the abuse of their rights, to international norms, such as the threatening of the free flow of commerce and international shipping in the Persian Gulf and Strait of Hormuz. Other norms like the nuclear ones, nuclear nonproliferation. The regime is using civilian nuclear technology to basically lay the groundwork for ultimately a nuclear weapon. So there's lots of different threats that the regime is posing, obviously also threats to Israel, obviously also threats to the United States, and threats to the Western-led liberal world order.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult to encapsulate the threat in one sentence, but you've done a damn good job there. Who is most at risk? And when I say of those three you've nominated, so Iranian nationals, there's a pretty significant anti-hijab uprising happening in Iran, courtesy of their very brave women. Is it the region or is it the world? Which is most at threat from Iran, do you think, if you were to scale each of those?
I think scaling it is a good idea, actually. I wish there were more policy exercises in Washington that would scale it. The first would have to be the Iranian people. You know, the longest-suffering victims of the Islamic Republic won't be found in neighboring Arab capitals, won't be found in the corridors of power in Washington. They will be found right there in Iran. People who have protested the Islamic Republic ever since its inception, different groups of people, even those who helped bring the Islamic Republic about. Think of leftists, think of Marxists, think of liberals, think of Democrats, think of constitutionalists, think of nationalists. All these groups were eventually purged by the Islamic Republic in the past 40 years. And what you've seen in that country is not just the narrowing of the political space, but the narrowing of the social space, where public life is increasingly governed by the views, values, and beliefs of an unelected few. And it's that unelected few that basically have put this country, this proud country, on a collision course with its neighbors. So that would be the second one, Israel, the Arab world, the immediate Near East, if you will, who have suffered greatly at the Iranian expansionist foreign policy project. Because ever since the Islamic Revolution came about in 1979, it's had this goal. And the goal is to export the revolution. And this means to the Muslim states in its backyard that it's going to try to co-opt those governments, either from the top down through wars or from the bottom up through the abuse of their political systems, through proliferating a series of proxies or agents or affiliates of Iran that are armed men across the region that do their dirty work, and then ultimately be able to marshal these at the non-Muslim forces in the region, such as Israel, and be able to punish, coerce, deter, threaten, and intimidate. And then ultimately, you know, the final one is the United States of America. You know, the United States is removed geographically from the Middle East, so it has quite a bit of leeway. But the U.S. is present, not only as the guardian of all the norms that the U.S. that Iranians tend to transgress, but also, of course, in its embassies in the region, in its myriad military facilities, military bases, military structures in the region, as well as Iran's abuse of things that the U.S. does stand for, such as the non-proliferation regime in the world.
The public comments by any number of iterations of Iranian leadership over the past, I guess I've been talking about this now for 10 or 15 years, the direct and overt threat to wipe Israel off the map. Do you take that seriously?
I do take that seriously, and I think we should afford, we being watchers of Iran from abroad, we should afford the men in power in Tehran the decency of them being able to speak their own minds. You know, these were men who cut their teeth on a series of issues in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, and then later on with the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. Yeah. And these issues fundamentally were anti-Westernism, anti-imperialism, anti-Zionism, anti-Semitism. And so these were the core foundational worldviews of some of these men. And they believe that their opposition to the Shah enabled them. The Shah was the late king of Iran.
Yeah, yeah.
Enabled them to really take that revolutionary dial up to 11. And if you had to chart them on the scale of Islamists, because, you know, there's Islamists around the region. There's fundamentalists who want to return to the previous teachings. But then there's another group of people who are on the other side, and they're progressives, and they want to use political Islam in a progressive way. Neither of those labels, progressive or fundamentalist, would apply to the men in charge in Iran. What they are is what they claim to be, which is revolutionaries. And revolutionaries often are serious about having their dreams become reality.
How strategic an error was the European and UK position in not backing Donald Trump's withdrawal from the nuclear deal? I know it's got a formal name, but most of my audience understand it as the anti-nuclear deal. To what extent are they going to pay for that, or are we going to pay for their reluctance to join up with Trump and bail out of it?
You know, in many ways, it was an act, not of strategy, for the European Union, the European states, and again, most unfortunately, much of the international community, to not back the U.S. there.
Including Australia, by the way. We've taken the European and the U.K. position here, which I think is an error, personally.
I would agree with you, but fortunately, you know, as an outside observer, someone who has the blessing of being in Australia now for the first time and being able to see the beautiful country that you have and talk to different people and hear different worldviews, I believe PM Morrison did an Iran policy review, and that is much more than I can say that some of the European states did.
Okay.
At least he was willing to revisit the proposition. At least Australian national policy was willing to engage. And they were able to, if you go to the DFAT website, it says they're willing to see that there are other deficiencies in Australia's policy towards Iran, such as ballistic missiles, such as terrorism, such as human rights, and realize that the nuclear deal is not the end-all be-all. And where Europe erred in not standing with its transatlantic partner, the United States of America, and standing with the world's foremost state sponsor of terrorism, the Islamic Republic of Iran, where it erred was that it basically bet that the nuclear deal would moderate Iran over time. And we're watching in slow motion how the antithesis of that proposition is being borne out.
Yeah, it's incredibly
Iran
brazen, isn't it?
Cash rich and aggressive.
Yeah, Benham, even, 48 hours ago, we had an announcement, in fact, less than that, 24 hours ago, we had an announcement from the Iranians that they were going to further enrich their uranium to closer to what would be described as weapons grade. I know there's a bit of a process involved in that, but what people don't understand is the early part of the enrichment process is difficult and time consuming. The back end of the process to get from sort of 20% pure up to weapons grade is not that long and not that hard.
And that's exactly right, and I'm glad you laid this out for your audience. There's a couple of key junctures here. I want to get into literally nuclear science, but the hardest part is 0 to 5%. You know, a couple of junctures there are 3.67%. That's what the nuclear deal was supposed to cap Iran's enrichment purity at.
Yep.
Iran, as of September 6th, has violated that cap. As of July 7th, has violated that cap. As of September 6th, has actually sought to grow the capability of the machines that actually enrich uranium so that the regime can do more with less. You know, the Iran centrifuges, because they've been spinning for so long, they can break over time. These are things made of aluminum alloy. Not all of them are made of tougher things like miraging steel, for instance. So these things are susceptible to being broken. And with the regime now, what it's doing is it's incrementally violating that nuclear deal, which was already so heavily slated in its favor, to begin to grow and add redundancy to its nuclear program to make good on its threats.
Okay. One of the other issues is the ongoing funding of Bashar al-Assad in Syria and also Hezbollah, which are gradually in the process, and this is my take, you may disagree with me, Benham, but gradually in the process of taking over Lebanon politically, militarily. I was, just to fill you in, a couple of months ago, I was on the Israel-Lebanon border, standing over an excavation that uncovered a Hezbollah tunnel coming from the Lebanese side into the Israeli side. I'm sure you're familiar with it. The proximity of everything, it's all very close there. How much of a threat does Hezbollah, and there have been skirmishes in the past week or so, pose to Israel directly beyond the broader nuclear Iranian threat? Of course, Hezbollah funded by Iran.
Oh my goodness, that was so succinct. You could have conducted the interview yourself, because I too was on the close to the Israel-Lebanon border a few months ago this summer, and you see firsthand how geography plays a role in all of this, and how Iran's export of the revolution is designed to have this westward momentum to eventually put the squeeze on Israel all the way out to the west on the eastern Mediterranean. Hezbollah, as you know, is Iran's most successful foreign policy project. Founded by the Iranians, armed, trained, equipped by the Iranians. There's this acronym that exists in Washington about Hezbollah, LH, Lebanese Hezbollah. But if you look at the activities of Hezbollah, it is not Lebanese in the slightest. It's trying to co-opt the Lebanese state on behalf of Iran. It's fighting on behalf of Iran in Syria in defense of the murderous Assad regime. It's training Iran-backed proxies and partners across the Middle East, be it in the battlefields of Iraq or Yemen, or back in the day training Arab Shia militias in Iran itself. Hezbollah is the most lethal foreign policy project of Iran, the most successful foreign policy project of Iran, and it's one that Iran is not going to stop arming, training, or equipping until it's confronted with a damning and serious choice.
Benamakar, just a couple of quick things. We're both sort of running out of time here, but I so much appreciate your input and your analysis here. The decision by the Australian government to send some naval and air assets to monitor ship movement through the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz specifically, you would think that's a good thing for us to be involved in?
I think that's a very wise thing, and it's not just a win for U.S. foreign policy to have more members of the Commonwealth join in on Operation Sentinel, which is the name given to this maritime security initiative, but it's in Australia's national interest to make sure that its supply of oil is secured. It's in Australia's economic interest to make sure that there's no disruptions to this supply, as well as it's in the normative interest of Australia. Australia will have issues with China's expanding power in the Indo-Pacific region, use of sea lanes, so it should stand for the norm everywhere.
There's been a couple of arrests of Australian, as I mentioned in the intro, Australian and UK dual nationals in Iran. There are some suggesting that this is a bit of a payback for our government's decision to back that operation in the Persian Gulf. Would you concur with that analysis?
You know, the regime will stop at nothing to threaten and intimidate those who stand for something other than what it stands for. My heart goes out to the Australian and British nationals that were in Iran that were taken. They were actually taken, based on what's been reported, to Evin prison. This is Iran's most notorious prison.
Yep.
Many freedom fighters have been taken to that prison, but also many pawns in Iran's larger game of competition with the West, people that have been used and abused, like these poor campers. Have also gone to that prison. And this is one way Iran likes to put pressure on the international community, because it knows that we value life much more than they value life.
Yes, it's an extraordinary dichotomy that really only becomes hyper-present, at least in your mind, when you're standing in the middle of it. It's very difficult to get your head around it from a distance, which is why I'm so grateful I had an opportunity to go to Israel. Tell me, just final question, if I can, Benham, the Iranian women who have been protesting vigorously against the compulsory wearing of the hijab and others. Is that likely to turn into anything that could destabilize the regime?
In many ways, it's already cut across the conceptual basis of this regime. Ever since the mandatory hijab laws have been in effect in Iran, there have been brave Iranian women of all different age groups, of all different strata of society, protesting and pushing back on this unfair infringement upon their rights. Those protests have amplified protests that came in December 2017, which is basically Iran's blue-collar protests, people that used to support the regime, the urban and rural poor, the religious classes, and they've all kind of magnified and coalesced. And in 2018, they pose a significant challenge to the Islamic Republic. They have withered out a little bit, but one thing is for certain. Because their demands have not been met, because their rights continue to be infringed, this will not be the last iteration.
It's a fascinating conversation. Benham, I could happily continue it for some hours with you, I'm sure. Time will beat us. I genuinely appreciate your time. Enjoy your time in Australia.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. He's a very, very knowledgeable man. Benham Talablu is his name. He's online from Sydney, but he's a senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, which is a Washington-based think tank. He's here on behalf of the Australia-Israel Jewish Affairs Council, and I thank them for putting me in contact with Benham. It's often difficult to get people of his caliber to have a chat on the radio about these sorts of issues in Australia. So there's a fair bit of food for thought there, but we cannot afford to ignore what the Iranians are up to, which is why I've supported the government decision to send our military assets, a limited number of them, but military assets to the Persian Gulf, because one of the things we didn't talk about there is the risk to the economy simply by choking the flow of oil. They don't even have to, as he says, they don't necessarily have to shoot anyone. They don't have to fire off a nuclear weapon. They can cripple the economy of the world by stopping shipping, getting out of that part of the world, because that's where a good slab of our oil comes from.
Another Tasmania Talks podcast. Go to tasmaniatalks.com.au for anything you've missed.